This episode is brought to you by Audi Canada.
The Canadian Medical Association has partnered with Audi Canada to offer CMA members a preferred incentive on select vehicle models. Purchase any new qualifying Audi model and receive an additional cash incentive based on the purchase type. Details of the incentive program can be found at audiprofessional.ca. Explore the full line of vehicles available to suit your lifestyle. The Audi driving experience is like no other.
The Scotiabank Healthcare Plus Physician Banking Program was co-designed with MD Financial Management for Canada's physicians. By combining MD's 50-year history of working exclusively with physician households and Scotiabank's expertise in banking, we're able to provide specialized advice and unique financial solutions tailored to your needs at every stage of your career. We're better together and more committed than ever to Canada's physicians. Find out more about how we can help you and visit www.md.ca/healthcareplus.
Bartonella quintana is a bacteria transmitted via body lice. It is the agent that caused trench fever during World War I, but in modern times, it has been associated with outbreaks among people who experience homelessness. If left untreated, it can also infect the heart and lead to endocarditis, which is what happened to the patients described today. I'm Dr. Neil Chanchlani, Associate Editor for the Canadian Medical Association Journal. Today I'm talking to Dr. Carl Budman, one of the authors of a CMAJ practice case article about a patient who contracted Bartonella quintana. I've reached Dr. Carl Budman in Winnipeg. Welcome.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Can you first tell me a bit about yourself, who you are and where you work, Carl?
Of course. I'm a fifth-year resident in a combined infectious disease and medical microbiology program at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg. So infectious diseases is the clinical part, and medical microbiology is a laboratory specialization. I'm originally from Montreal, Quebec, but I've hopped around quite a bit for my training. And I work at the Health Sciences Center and St. Boniface Hospitals in Winnipeg. And I'm particularly interested in using some of the tools of infectious diseases and medical microbiology to attempt to interrupt cycles of poverty and illness. The catchment area here in Winnipeg is unique. There's quite a large inner city population. The city is also really well known for Indigenous scholarship and great activism. And we care for patients in Winnipeg, but also care for many patients who fly down south from northern Manitoba and sometimes Nunavut.
You saw multiple patients with Bartonella quintana. Can you tell me about the first patient you saw? How did he present to your team, and what was his relevant history?
So the first patient I saw presented acutely with shortness of breath, tachypnea, and hypoxemia. And I was only consulted on around day two, but he presented to the emergency room also with pleuritic chest pain and was actually quite quickly intubated due to worsening hypoxemia and respiratory distress. Interestingly, this patient had a history of HIV, which he acquired from remote injection drug use. He also had a history of homelessness and was living in and out of shelters for a number of years. But at the time that he presented to hospital, he had lived in supportive housing for many months at that point. When I was called, they were calling me regarding the etiology of his hypoxemia, but also his presentation, because there were some unusual aspects to his presentation, and they wanted some kind of infectious disease guidance in terms of what could be going on.
How long was he unwell for before he presented?
So this is a very interesting part. He presented acutely only really with 24 hours of being unwell, and then with an acute deterioration of really just minutes. And he had a 24-hour history of shortness of breath and some pleuritic chest pain that deteriorated acutely. It was 24 to 48 hours. The history was a little bit vague, but within a day or two prior to presentation, I spoke to people who lived with him at the supportive housing unit, and they mentioned that he was, quote unquote, the life of the party at dinner the day before. All of his friends and his roommates mentioned that he was actually apparently close to his baseline, and then things changed acutely prior to presentation.
And on day two, when you were consulted, what was the working differential, or what was the thought process behind calling infectious disease or thinking that there was an infectious disease component to his presentation?
So prior to calling me, they did a CTPE and a CT abdopelvis. And the CT did show some pulmonary emboli and splenomegaly and splenic infarcts, as well as abdominal aneurysms. And a bedside echo showed a large mitral valve vegetation. And so they called me for treatment and guidance on underlying endocarditis. So that was their provisional diagnosis. And they had taken blood cultures first and then prescribed piperacillin and tazobactam empirically. And so they called infectious diseases to help with managing the endocarditis.
And can you just remind listeners what the key blood work and imaging findings were that were supportive of a diagnosis of endocarditis or bacteremia, and what blood work and imaging findings pointed against a diagnosis of bacteremia or endocarditis?
Sure. So initially, his complete blood count did show some elements of neutrophilia, which is not specific for endocarditis. And he did have an acute kidney injury, which is not specific for endocarditis and may occur with many septic presentations. It was really the imaging that pointed to endocarditis with the combination of the echo, both the transthoracic and transesophageal, which was later done, and the CT with contrast, which revealed the embolization both to the lungs and the spleen, as well as the endovascular aneurysms of the abdominal aorta, and also some of the renal arteries. So that was really what pointed to a disseminated endovascular infection, such as endocarditis. Blood cultures were initially drawn, and at 48 hours were still negative, even though they were drawn prior to antibiotics. And this was something that led us closer to our diagnosis, because it suggested possible culture negative endocarditis. So with most cases of endocarditis, the cultures usually on day, you know, two, three, sometimes a little bit later, but will be positive. And there is a limited number of pathogens that actually cause endocarditis without positive blood cultures routinely.
And just before we go on talking about diagnosis surrounding that, what were his inflammatory markers doing at the time of initial presentation?
They were elevated. I can't recall exactly how elevated they were at the time. And of course, these are also nonspecific. So he presented clearly unwell. He was intubated quite quickly at the scene. And there is a component of elevated inflammatory markers, which can occur with any septic presentation. What was relatively unique was the size of the vegetation. So the vegetation was over 2 centimeters on his mitral valve, and the acute presentation. So when an over 2 centimeter vegetation doesn't occur overnight, but the collateral suggested that he had really been relatively well until days prior to presentation, at which time he presented with really symptoms of the embolization rather than the infection itself.
And were there any diagnoses or pathogens you thought fit with this picture of disseminated infection and micro and macro emboli, as you say? Or was the jury still out in what your potential pathogens might have been?
In this particular patient, I was suspecting Bartonella quintana. And the reason was because of his history of homelessness and the fact that on exam, I actually noticed a fair number of punctate hemorrhagic small lesions on his legs and elsewhere that could be consistent with body lice ectoparasitosis or a body lice infestation. In the context of culture negative endocarditis, so having evidence of endocarditis, a large vegetation, some disseminated endovascular infection seen on imaging, but no positive organism grown within a couple of days, we ordered testing for Bartonella, both quintana as well as Bartonella henselae, the agent that causes cat scratch disease. We also ordered serology for Coxiella burnettii, which causes Q fever, and Brucella, which causes brucellosis. However, we were really suspecting Bartonella quintana, which ultimately was the etiology in this case.
And what are the differences in clinical presentation that you might get between those two different types of Bartonella?
That's a great question, Neil. Both Bartonella henselae and Bartonella quintana can cause endocarditis. However, Bartonella henselae is associated with cat scratch disease, which mostly manifests in terms of lymphadenopathy. It can rarely manifest in different ways, especially in an HIV-positive patient, and can cause endocarditis. Now, Bartonella quintana is transmitted by body lice, doesn't usually cause lymphadenopathy, and can cause a systemic disease known as trench fever, and can also cause endovascular complications such as endocarditis.
Can you just tell us a little bit more about culture-negative growth and what the implications are for onwards investigations and treatment when you see culture-negative growth?
So culture-negative endocarditis really by definition means you have evidence of endocarditis, but our routine blood cultures, usually three of them, are negative at day five. And the reason why we say day five is because this is the duration that most laboratories hold their blood cultures. Now, culture-negative endocarditis has a list of different pathogens. Can you identify those pathogens? Of course you can, but it's not with the routine cultures that we do. So they'll be missed on the routine cultures, and that's why we call them culture-negative. If you think about them or suspect them, you can diagnose them in different ways, but you have to discuss with the medical microbiologist on call in the laboratory to improve your yield, because they will need special growth and incubation conditions and also prolonged incubation time for the most part. If you are suspecting culture-negative endocarditis, the initial step is really serology. And even if you, before you identify the pathogen, if you are suspecting it, often people add doxycycline or some different antibiotics to target organisms that usually cause culture-negative endocarditis, which are slightly different than the organisms that cause culture-positive endocarditis.
And just remind myself and listeners what those pathogens are.
Sure. So the pathogens are Bartonella, so both quintana and henselae. There's Coxiella burnettii, the etiology of Q fever. This is associated with pregnant cats and different types of animal exposure. It also can be transmitted downwind from certain farm areas with outbreaks of Q fever, also with sheep and sometimes goats. There's also Brucella or brucellosis, which can be associated with culture-negative endocarditis. There's actually quite a long list. There's mycoplasma can cause this, Whipple's disease or Trophorema whippli can cause this, but often the first three are higher up on the list, with actually Bartonella quintana being the most common. And of course, it is important though to make sure that it isn't quote unquote false culture negative. So it can appear culture negative if someone was given antibiotics prior to the culture, in which case none of these obscure pathogens will be the cause. It might be something run of the mill, such as streptococcus or potentially staph that was just suppressed with prior antibiotics. So by definition, we need, before we invoke a diagnosis of culture negative endocarditis, we need to ensure that the cultures were taken prior to antibiotics.
Thank you very much for that nice primer. And I didn't mean to test your Latin along the way.
That's okay. In infectious disease, there's a lot of Latin. It's clearly not a dead language for us.
So just bringing it back to that patient in front of you, you consulted on day two, some blood work, some imaging had been done before you arrived. There were cultures on their way. And how did your patient respond to the initial steps of treatment that you'd taken in the first couple of days following this presentation?
So in the first couple of days, he was stable, but still was intubated and was still requiring pressors. And his mitral valve showed significant and severe regurgitation. And so he was still in heart failure. He was at that point still on piperacillin, tazobactam, and vancomycin, and the cultures were still negative. But due to his refractory heart failure and the evidence of embolization to multiple organs, he was taken to the operating room for cardiovascular surgery and both mitral and aortic valve replacement. So the transesophageal echocardiogram revealed 25 millimeter by 9 millimeter vegetation on the mitral valve with severe regurgitation, as well as smaller vegetations on the aortic valve.
What was the role of fever in his case? Did he ever mount a fever? And was that at all telltale for how his trajectory would go?
So for him, he actually did not mount a significant fever, in my recollection. Now, sometimes in people who are acutely unwell with a very large inflammatory response and embolization, having a fever would not be surprising, but this was not actually a significant component of his presentation, which is also unusual, as most patients with endocarditis will actually present with fever that will last for days or weeks if it's subacute, or sometimes even months prior to diagnosis, whereas that was not a salient feature of his presentation.
It's a really interesting point, that because we tend to think of endocarditis as fever coming in waves, exactly as you say. And after the surgery, how did he do?
So he did incredibly well. I was very impressed with how he did. So he was taken for valvular replacement surgery, and he was given antibiotics. At first, this was broad spectrum. I mentioned piperacillin, tazobactam, and vancomycin. This was then switched to ceftriaxone and vancomycin and doxycycline. And then we actually got the etiology. So the cultures were still negative. We had tissue from his valve, and we sent that for extra testing. And that was able to identify Bartonella quintana. And he actually did recover very well. And we were able to follow him up after discharge from hospital. But I remember seeing him after extubation off pressors and doing very well within a week after cardiac surgery. I just wanted to clarify one thing regarding the patient's treatment. The guidelines suggest gentamicin and doxycycline for 6 weeks for Bartonella quintana endocarditis. Because of our patient's acute kidney injury, he only tolerated a couple of days of gentamicin. And then we switched the gentamicin to ceftriaxone and treated him with ceftriaxone and doxycycline for 6 weeks of the time of cardiovascular surgery. And there is some anecdotal evidence and a number of case reports of success with ceftriaxone and doxycycline rather than gentamicin and doxycycline for treating Bartonella quintana. And he did very well on this regimen.
Bartonella quintana became quite well known during World War I, hence its association with trench fever. What do we know about its natural history?
Sure. Bartonella quintana and trench fever was first described in 1916. And at that point, the descriptions really mentioned a 5 or 7 day illness with fever that would come and go. So it would come for around 5 days, go for 5 days, and was often associated with sometimes a rash, sometimes splenomegaly or left upper quadrant pain, sometimes shin pain. Those early descriptions actually didn't mention significant endovascular complications. And then there was a very interesting study in 1919, so over 100 years ago, that employed something called xenodiagnosis. And xeno is X-E-N-O, meaning other, and then diagnosis meaning, obviously diagnosis. And this was a technique where you actually use the vector to amplify the pathogen that you're interested in. So what this scientist did, named BM, in 1919 was examine the body lice from patients who had trench fever. And he dissected their guts and he looked in their feces and actually identified Bartonella quintana. At that time, he actually called it quote unquote rickettsial bodies. But that was the first description in 1919 that body lice were the vector of Bartonella quintana. Now, since then, there have been many different manifestations outside of wartime conditions. So there have been little outbreaks, and some of them actually not so little, mostly described in the south of France, in Marseille, also in some places in the United States, in Seattle, in Baltimore, in San Francisco. And it has also been described in refugee camps throughout the world, mostly in East Africa, so in Ethiopia and in Rwanda and Burundi in the 90s, surrounding the genocide there. And some studies suggest that in some refugee camps in Ethiopia, it is the number one cause of endocarditis.
And can you summarize the key developments in our understanding of Bartonella quintana from many years ago to what we understand about it now? Have things changed significantly?
Some things have changed. We've come to recognize that it is relatively common in underhoused populations or populations experiencing homelessness, and that some studies show upwards of 10, 15, sometimes 20% positivity of having been exposed to Bartonella quintana. We do also know that there is a long-standing chronic bacteremia in these patients. So Bartonella quintana may not cause very much of a large inflammatory response, but may actually be in the bloodstream for months on end. Studies out of that group in Marseille have shown that PCR and sometimes culture can be positive for months on end, with patients being ambulatory and often only mildly symptomatic. So these are changes from the earlier descriptions of trench fever. That said, there's still much we don't know about Bartonella quintana, and there's still some debates about the best ways of managing this disease and how common it is and how to actually prevent endovascular complications from occurring among people who have serology that shows previous exposure.
And what's our understanding of how incident or prevalent Bartonella quintana is nowadays compared to before?
In Canada, Bartonella quintana or trench fever is not a reportable or mandatorily reportable disease, so we don't have a denominator to know. So ultimately, we do not know how prevalent this disease is. We do know from some small studies in the United States and in France that among people with risk factors, so people who are underhoused or homeless and who have body lice, or have had body lice, that it can be quite common. As I mentioned before, approximately 1/6 or 1/5 of patients may have shown previous exposure. There are some issues with serology, of course. And so we don't ultimately know how common it is. And I suspect that among people without any risk factors, it is exceedingly rare, but that it is underdiagnosed among patients who do have risk factors, such as homelessness and exposure to body lice and some substance use disorders, such as chronic alcoholism.
You mentioned that your patient presented with a 24 to 48 hour history of being unwell, including short of breath. You also mentioned a history of body lice. How did that play a role, or how should that play a role in diagnosis? And what are some other common signs and symptoms of this for others to be made aware about?
That's a great point. Ultimately, we know that this disease is transmitted by body lice. It's transmitted actually from the feces of body lice, which trigger an itchy reaction or pruritic reaction. And then people scratch, cause small microabrasions in the skin, and the bacteria goes into the bloodstream through the feces of the body lice. And the bacteria can survive for a long time, many weeks, in dried feces of body lice on people's clothing. ultimately, you cannot get Bartonella quintana, as far as we know, without body lice. So either evidence of body lice on exam, either body lice seen in the clothing and the seams of patients who are underhoused, or seeing scabs and lesions and old scars of body lice, are quite helpful in making this diagnosis, or at least increasing your pretest probability and your spidey sense, so to speak, that this diagnosis may be there.
And what would you recommend the next step, once you suspect this condition, what would you recommend the next steps towards reaching a diagnosis should be?
Serology is really your next best step, especially for patients who may be ambulatory and not acutely unwell and for whom you will not get a tissue diagnosis. So the first step is getting serology, which is in some ways a screening test. Serology does have some limitations. There is cross-reactivity between Bartonella quintana, the agent of trench fever, and Bartonella hensile, the pathogen that causes cat scratch disease. But I would start by serology. And if someone does have evidence of endocarditis with either a history of chest pain or a new murmur on exam, an echo findings of a vegetation or new regurgitation, and if they will get surgery, I would send the valve for 16S RNA amplification and PCR. Now, prior to antibiotics, if you are suspecting Bartonella quintana, you can also attempt culture by calling your medical microbiology friends in the lab, saying that you suspect the diagnosis for certain reasons. And then they may do certain fancy techniques to improve your yield or their yield of culturing Bartonella, notably keeping the cultures for a long time, up to around 6 weeks, and sometimes actually employing different techniques to break apart red cells, because Bartonella quintana lives intra-erythrocytically. So it lives in the erythrocytes. And so the culture is improved if you lyse the erythrocytes. And this can be done either with freezing and thawing or something called lysis centrifugation. But the important part is, if you want to try to culture this, it's important to talk to your medical microbiology laboratory. And they may also assess for possible PCR. But really the first steps are to see if someone has evidence of body lice, might have a clinical syndrome that is consistent with either trench fever or Bartonella quintana endocarditis. Often these patients also have splenomegaly, so if they have, you know, left upper quadrant pain or splenomegaly on exam, clinical findings of body lice with scabs on their skin, maybe a new murmur, then I would progress by getting an echo and ordering serology and taking it stepwise from there.
And how should clinicians be guided as to when to instigate advanced imaging?
Advanced imaging should really be undertaken based on the symptom presentation. So I'm not suggesting that everybody who has body lice get a pan CT with contrast, but I would have a low threshold to ask patients who have body lice whether they have left upper quadrant pain, even if it's dull. I would examine them for any splenomegaly. I'd also listen to their heart and ask them about any symptoms they may have, and then use those symptoms to guide for their imaging. And then if there are symptoms, then I would undertake either echo or a CT or an ultrasound of the abdomen. In some of our patients, they've had mycotic aneurysms that bled into the brain, and thus they presented with decreased level of consciousness and neurologic presentations. And in those cases, obviously, MRI and CT with contrast are indicated to evaluate those neurologic presentations.
Over the next few months, after you treated your first patient, three more patients with Bartonella quintana were identified in Winnipeg. Can you tell me a bit about them?
Yeah, of course. So when I first diagnosed this case, the patient was doing relatively well and was stable. And then I was called the next week about a patient who had a similar presentation. In fact, he had spent time at the exact same inner city shelter as case number one. He also had scars and lesions on his skin from previous body lice. He also had a history of chronic substance use. In his case, it was chronic alcohol use. And so we ordered the testing, and in some ways, I was baffled when it came back positive. And we repeated the testing multiple times because this pathogen is quite rarely diagnosed. There's only been 3 or 4 cases described in Canada in 20 years. And so to find 2 cases in 2 weeks is very unusual. And so we repeated all of the testing in this case, including the serology and the molecular test with the 16S PCR, as this second patient also went for cardiovascular surgery, and all of it confirmed Bartonella quintana. Then around a month later, I was actually at Health Sciences Center, a different hospital, and I saw a patient who presented originally with an intracranial hemorrhage from a mycotic aneurysm. This was a patient in his 30s who had also spent some time at this shelter and had also spent some time in corrections and had gone back and forth from a rural community that is fly-in in northern Manitoba. And in his case, after he had an intracranial bleed, echocardiogram did show vegetation also on the mitral valve and with blood cultures that were negative. So we sent off the serology, and in his case, his serology was also very high with titers through the roof, greater than 1 in 8,100. Now for him, he could not undergo cardiovascular surgery due to his severe bleed in his brain and the need for anticoagulation if he were to have cardiovascular surgery. And so he was treated with antibiotics, ceftriaxone, doxycycline. He was initially treated with vancomycin as well. And he did improve from the endocarditis perspective, but has some chronic neurologic deficits from the intracranial hemorrhage. So at that point, I had 3 cases in 2 months. And I was talking to people in the department. I presented at rounds about these cases. And then one doctor, an ID doc here, said, "Hey, I also saw a case of endocarditis, and I never got a diagnosis. I wonder if he also has this disease." And we looked up this patient, and it turns out he had one also received meals at the same shelter, came from the same remote community as case number 3, and was currently admitted at the time, serendipitously, at the time that we were looking for some acute psychosis. And so we chatted with him, chatted with his family, and were able to pursue testing, just serology, and the serology once again confirmed Bartonella with titers that were greater than 1 in 8,100, so really through the roof. Now in this patient, he had already been treated for his endocarditis, and repeat serology months later, and PCR, and repeat imaging showed improvement and in fact resolution. So we did not reinitiate therapy in him. But in total, this was 4 patients, all of them men, all between the ages of approximately 25 and 50, all of them with a history of underhousing in some capacity and exposure to shelters who had this disease. And really to hammer home how surprising this was, there've only been 3 or 4 cases of this disease reported in Canada since the mid-90s. And then in approximately 4 months, only in one city, in Winnipeg, we diagnosed just as many cases.
It's a really fascinating cluster that you managed to come across, really, and some really interesting risk factors and potential associations that you were able to identify. Thanks for being able to write it up for CMHA.
Thanks, Neil.
Moving forward, what do you want to tell fellow healthcare professionals about Bartonella quintana? And why did you want to draw attention to this particular case by publishing this article?
Ultimately, while it is a very interesting case, this cluster of Bartonella Quintana is a tragedy. It really reflects the fact that our inner city populations are living in conditions that are similar to warlike conditions. This is a disease of immense poverty. This is a disease that is associated with World War I in the trenches. It's associated with refugee camps in surrounding genocide in East Africa. This is a terrible disease. And it's one that really does reflect the very poor conditions that our underhoused population experiences. So one aspect of drawing attention to this disease is the public health advocacy component. Hopefully some of these cases translate into eventually into improved outcomes for patients who are underhoused. That includes improved access to shelters, less overcrowding at shelters, more funding for shelters, improved access to clean clothing and the ability to wash and dry clothing, as well as in rural communities, improved access to affordable housing and running water. Two out of the four cases that we presented had links to the same remote community that still struggles, unfortunately, with running water. So one aspect is really a public health advocacy aspect. Unfortunately, in Winnipeg and in much of Canada, populations experiencing homelessness are disproportionately shown to be Indigenous. And these cases do not in any way mean to perpetuate negative stereotypes of Indigeneity. As Dr. Janet Smiley and Jesse Thistle mentioned recently in the CMAJ, really the disproportionate number of Indigenous people experiencing homelessness in Canada relates to ongoing colonial disruptions that have significant effects on patients' health, well-being, and mental health. And three out of our four cases here are Indigenous people. And so this does reflect a public health need and emergency for increased collaboration, for more resources to really be funneled to improve the care of people experiencing homelessness in Canada generally, and Indigenous people who are unfortunately disproportionately affected in this population. Other than the public health advocacy component, I wanted to bring up these cases for the general clinician as well as the infectious disease specialist. Often diseases of poverty are underdiagnosed and they're in some ways misunderstood. I've had experiences where infectious disease physicians have either canceled my test for Bartonella or told me that they've worked in inner city infectious disease for 20 years and have never seen a case. And there's things that we all miss. I guess I want to publicize these cases just to encourage people to have an open mind, especially regarding diseases that disproportionately affect people who face significant barriers to care, and to think about Bartonella Quintana next time they're treating someone who is underhoused and who may have a disseminated illness that is poorly understood or poorly diagnosed.
Some really important messaging there for both public health policymakers as well as clinicians. Thank you for writing that case series for CMAJ and for raising it to our attention. And thanks very much for joining me today, Carl.
Oh, it was a pleasure, Neil. Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Dr. Carl Budman. To read the article he co-authored, visit cmaj.ca. Also, don't forget to subscribe to CMAJ podcasts on SoundCloud or a podcast app, and let us know how we're doing by leaving a rating. I'm Dr. Neil Chanchlani, Associate Editor for CMAJ. Thank you for listening.